Hi, Zirkin, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. And it's exciting to look around and see many familiar faces, familiar people with whom I've had the opportunity to interact at YU in this decade and in decades past, and perhaps in decades to come as well. I want to share with you, I want to introduce you or reintroduce you to a man who's very close to my heart, a man who has had profound impact on the Jewish world over the last three centuries, a man who in his lifetime was extraordinarily controversial to the point that he was essentially kicked across Europe, while within mere decades of his passing, with the rise of the next major controversy in Jewish Europe, was warmly embraced by both sides. A man whose Sefer was published over 150 times over the last three centuries since its first publication in Amsterdam in 1740. And he's a man who breaks many, many barriers and many, many assumptions. If I were to say the word Musar Sefer, if I were to say the term Musar Sefer and you free associated, what comes to your mind? What picture do you see? I won't put you on the spot. But I imagine maybe you're thinking an otherworldly fellow, an old tzaddik, long white beard, sort of living on another planet, not a part of our world. The man who wrote what is arguably the most popular Musar Sefer still over the last three centuries, Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, was none of those things. For one, he did not have a long white beard because he passed away at the age of 40. He was never old, and he, as far as we know, never had a beard. He was a man who was an extraordinarily holy person, who during his lifetime was exceptionally controversial. Whose Talmidim were primarily medical students. A man who wrote plays in contemporary 18th century Italian style, and a man who conversed with angels. I want to introduce you, or reintroduce you, to the author of Mesillas Yesharim, to Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, the Ramchal. A man who lived from 1707 to 1747, but to appreciate his brief and profoundly impactful life, I want to back up just a drop, and appreciate the quiet century into which Ramchal was born. If we could take a couple of moments for an incredibly brief 2,000-year thumbnail portrait of Jewish history, if you're thinking back from the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash in the year 70 to this day, we could divide the last 2,000 years into roughly, very roughly, 500-year chunks. The first 500 years from before the Churban Bayis, from around the year, loosely, the year 1 to year 500, is the period of the Talmud, the Tanaim who are writing the Mishnah, the Amoraim who are writing the Gemara. That period comes to a close a little bit after the year 500. The next 500 years, from 500, 550, until around 1,000, is the period of the Gaonim. The Gemara has been written. The center of gravity remains, the intellectual center of gravity of the Jewish people remains in Babel, remains in Babylonia. The two yeshivas in Sur and Pumbedisa remain the nerve center of the Jewish people. Questions are streaming from across the world, from east, from west, to everything is being mediated, and leadership, the Torah leadership is coming from Babel, from Sura, from Pumbedisa, up until the end of the period of the Gaonim. Around the year 1000, the period of the Gaonim ends, the period of the Rishonim begin, and that's marked by a shift in the center of gravity from east to west. From Babel, from Babylonia, from the Tigris and Euphrates, Iran and Iraq, to the countries that surround the Mediterranean. Over the course of the period of the Rishonim, over the 500 years or so, from 1000 to 1500, speaking very loosely, names that are very familiar to us, Rashi, Yehuda Halevi, the Rambam, the Ramban, the Rabbeinu Tam, the other Bali Atosfos, the Rashba, and so forth, the Rosh, the Maram of Rothenburg, that period is marked by a Jewish leadership that centered around the Mediterranean, France and Spain and Portugal and Morocco, eventually moving upward into Germany as well. And that period of the Rishonim ends around the year 1500 or so, marked by the writing of the Shulchan Aruch by Rav Yosef Karo, who was a Sephardi who had moved from Spain to Eretz Israel. And the Ramah, in parallel, writing in Poland, in Agos Shulchan Aruch, the Shulchan Aruch Ramah together producing what we think of as the Shulchan Aruch, that marks the end of the period of the Rishonim, the beginning of the period of the Achronim, when Jewish leadership moves more broad, begins to move to Eretz Israel, and also begins to migrate more extensively away from the Mediterranean into Eastern Europe. So the beginning of the period of the Achronim, mentioned the 1500s, you have the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah, and there's an incredible amount of writing and creativity and production of Svarim throughout the period of the Rishonim into the mid-1600s. The early 1600s are still marked by some very famous names, particularly early commentators on the Shulchan Aruch, the Magen Avraham, the Taz, the Shach, and so forth. Up until around the mid-1600s. From the mid-1700s and on, a century later, is once again an explosion of famous names, of famous Sfarim, of famous movements, the Pnei Yehoshua and the Maharsha, and the noted Yehuda, the Chasam Sofer, the Baal HaTanya, the Baal Shem Tov, the Gra, Reb Chaim Volozhin, and the list goes on and on. That renewal, that renaissance of Jewish learning and Jewish teaching and Jewish writing and Jewish creativity begins in the mid-1700s. But there's this quiet century from the mid-1600s till the mid-1700s. Ramchal was born smack in the middle of that quiet century, and we'll appreciate his life more fully if we understand the 1-2 punch that created that quiet century. The first strike landed in the 1640s. In 1648, 1649, the Khmelnytsky pogroms, Tach V'Tat, these hordes come streaming into Eastern Europe from the East, laying waste everywhere they went, to communities in general, but with a particular viciousness reserved for Jewish communities. And just geographically, they make their greatest mark and they wreak the greatest damage to the Jewish community of Poland. And Poland lay in a shambles from which it would not really rebuild itself for a good century. And so at that point, the center at the end of the 1640s, with Poland having fallen apart, Poland being decimated, if not tertiated, by these pogroms, the Germany, which had been largely left untouched by Khmelnytsky because they were further to the west, really the center of gravity of Jewish life shifts from Poland to Germany. And then the second punch falls. In the 1650s, between the destruction of Khmelnytsky and the numerology that surrounded the year 1666, there was a sense of despair paired with the sort of sense of unrealistic hope that often gives rise to false messiahs, to Mashiach Sheker. And the 1650s and 1660s saw one of the, if one could say, most successful Jewish Mashiach Sheker of all time, the second most impactful, just by the numbers, Jewish false messiah was Shabtai Tzvi, whose movement began over the course of the 1650s and built and built and built into the 1660s. And finally in 1666 is the major showdown. The Sultan of the Ottoman Empire, the major power broker in much of Europe at the time, begins to feel threatened by Shabtai Tzvi. He's beginning to openly, he had already been driving he and Natan of Gaza, who fancied himself the Eliyahu HaNavi to Shabtai Tzvi's Mashiach, they had been driving a movement, they had been building followers, they had been building followers by the thousands, by the tens of thousands, perhaps also by the hundreds of thousands. Their center was a Turkey, but their impact spread across much of Europe, all the way to England. Samuel Pepys, the famous British diarist of the 1600s, writes that the real estate market was plummeting because so many people were convinced that within months, if not years, they would be moving to Eretz Israel. So who needed? People were selling properties for pennies on the dollar. Samuel Pepys writes about the enormous odds that there was a Jew who was offering like tremendous, betting an enormous number of guineas that the Jewish Messiah would reveal himself within X number of months. And Jews and Christians alike, many Muslims were jumping on the bandwagon. Shabtai Tzvi began to become more and more openly antinomian. He began to preach that halacha no longer applies, now where you be Mosa Mashiach. He very famously began to violate halacha flagrantly in public. He was eating non-kosher food, and he crafted his own bracha, Matir Isurim. One of the most famous publicity stunts was there was an announcement that Shabtai Tzvi would be married in the town square, I believe of Smyrna or Izmir. And people showed up by the thousands. The kala was, uncharacteristically, already standing under the chuppah in a very, very thick, we would call it anachronistically, a chassidish veil. No one could see the kala whatsoever. She's already under the chuppah. Shabtai Tzvi walks down, bedecked in his royal garb. And then they dramatically pulled the veil off to reveal the kala, who was a Sefer Torah. Because after all, if you're in that sort of crazed frame of mind, well, if you're Mashiach, who better to marry than the Torah? But as I mentioned, by 1666, there was a lot of open talk about him being the king of the Jews, raising an army, overtaking the Ottoman Empire, and march on Yerushalayim. The Sultan played hardball. So he called Shabtai Tzvi and he imprisoned him. But they convinced themselves that this is all part of the Hizgalus of the Rebbe, Hizgalus of Mashiach. He needs to go into jail in order to reveal himself. And then the showdown. The Sultan says to Shabtai Tzvi, I'm giving you two choices, the sword or the turban. You can convert to Islam or that'll be the end of your life. Shabtai Tzvi chose the turban. At that point, there were still a couple of diehards who thought this was all part of the revelation of Mashiach, but the vast majority of his followers realized that he was a fake, a phony, a fraud. And they lost their faith in him, and with that, their faith in Judaism in general took an incredible hit. So many people had rebuilt their understanding and connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and to Yadus. They had rebuilt it and reframed it as being mediated through Shabtai Tzvi. Then when he turned out to be not what he was, the connection to Yadus was shaken for many, many tens of thousands. Connection to Yadus was shaken. Connection to healthy living in general was shaken. And these are the 1-2 punch. That between 1640s and 1660s, between Khmelnytsky pogroms and the Shabtai Tzvi debacle, together these put Jewish Europe into a tailspin from which it would not fully recover until, as we described, until the mid-1700s. And it left its mark permanently. I understand that the RJC is in many ways a proud member of the German Jewish tradition. I spent, Baruch Hashem, many, many years of my life living and continue to spend many decades of my life learning and teaching in Washington Heights. I don't know what the practices are here in the KAJ, in the Breuer's community in Washington Heights. To this day, they do not say Brich Shmei. Brich Shmei does not appear in the Redelheim Seder. I think we did say it this morning. We do say it. But the Frankfurt community continues to not recite Brich Shmei because it's a passage from the Zohar. And ironically, in the Middle Ages, in the period of the Rishonim, the German Jewish community was arguably the main center of Kabbalah. Even the Svardi Mekubalim, like the Ramban, had been trained by Rabbeinu Ezra, Rabbeinu Ephraim, Ashkenazi Mekubalim. And yet from the 1660s and on, the German Jewish community in particular, which suffered so terribly by the abuse of Kabbalah and the abuse of the signs and symbols and flavor of mysticism at the hands of Shabtai Tzvi and his crew, they developed an allergy, an aversion to Kabbalah that continues to this very day. And it's in that context, in the midst of this quiet century, so to speak, that Moshe Chaim is born in 1707, in Padua, which was a smaller town near the much larger establishment city of Venice. And he is, as I've mentioned to Talmidim of mine, MTA, over the years, one need not be unusually gifted to grow into a great Talmud Chacham. One need not be a genius to grow into a great Talmud Chacham. Sometimes Echam are, sometimes Echam are not. Rosh Chaim Lutzato appears to have been, indeed, a man blessed with an unusual mind and unusual heart. He quickly outgrows the local yeshiva by around Bar Mitzvah or so. Soon after Bar Mitzvah, he's outgrown the local yeshiva in Padua. And he joins a very unique chabura. And here's what's fascinating about Padua. The otherwise sleepy town of Padua had one distinction, Jewishly, in the early 1700s. And at first it sounds like an irrelevant detail, but as we'll see, it was dispositive. The University of Padua was the only university in all of Europe in the early 1700s which admitted Jews to its medical school, which at first sounds like a curious, irrelevant historical detail until you realize that means that any Jewish mother across Europe who wanted to say, my son the doctor, is sending her son to Padua to study. In fact, several decades later, late 1700s, I understand that you have the privilege of studying the history and learning and teaching an impact of the Gra of the Rabbi Zerkind. The Gra's physician was a doctor by the name of Yechezkel Gordon, who had studied in medical school at Padua, because where else? We'll come back to Yechezkel Gordon momentarily. So the Ramchal outgrows his yeshiva. And he's looking for an opportunity to learn. He's connected to a very great Talmud Chacham by the name of Yeshaya Basan, who authored a Sefer not so well known nowadays, a Lachme Toda, a response to Sefer. But he quickly, he gravitates towards a Chevra, towards the Chabura of Yom Tamei Chachamim, who had gathered, like Yechezkel Gordon, from Litta and from around Europe in Padua to study medicine. And these were aspiring doctors and aspiring Tamei Chachamim, who made their own base medrash, their own chabura for learning, and he joined this chabura, and they quickly recognized, although he's a couple years younger, he was meshichmo lamala, head and shoulders above the rest. They take him as their rosh chabura, as their leader of their small yeshiva, and the learning is continuing. The learning is continuing with them. And this we have published, you can find in the libraries, a slim sefer called the Takanos Beis HaMedrash. The practices of this Beis Medrash, of this Beis Medrash in Venice of medical students. It's fascinating. It's fascinating to see as you, the insights that you glean. You see there was a tremendous amount of ambitious Gemara learning going on. There was a tremendous amount of ambitious Kabbalah study going on in this Beis HaMedrash. One of the unique practices they had is that I believe it was from Vasikin all the way until Mincha Ma'ariv, there was every day unbroken, continuous study of Zohar in shifts because everyone had to go to class. But different guys had class. You know, first year medical student, third year medical student, this one's taking gross anatomy. I'm not exactly sure what was on the syllabus in 18th century medical schools. But different Talmidim, different members of the Chabur were coming and going, and they worked out a system. There was always at least one pair of Chavrusas on shift, min ha-bokev ad ha-erev, and the way they learned a little different than we usually think about learning. There was a big open Zohar, and one set of Chavrusas is learning, and then when the next shift came in, they would finger on the place, and they would pick up where the last group had stopped. Clearly people who had been through this Sefer many times in the past. There was a vigorous analytic Gemara study going on as well. It's clear from the description. And then there's this fascinating, sort of at first striking, line in the Takanos Beis HaMedrash. They talk about the Sidrei HaYeshiva. There were fixed times when many people were learning. But when it was Bein HaSedarim, when it was the off hours, any member of the Beis HaMedrash had the right to ask everyone else to leave. Any member of the Beis HaMedrash during off hours, Bein HaSedarim, had the right to say, I want the Beis HaMedrash to myself, ask everyone else to leave. Look at that, you wonder what it's all about. And then you begin to read the correspondence that surrounds, here I have two volumes, the Igros Ramchal, the Yoreh Moshe, correspondence that surrounded the controversy of the Ramchal, and you begin to piece it together. You had the right. This was a place of both vigorous Gemara study and vigorous Kabbalah study. So if you needed, you know, Breslovers are famous for doing his bodidus, going out into the fields or onto the roof to find a quiet place to be with HaKadosh Baruch Hu to meditate. In Padua, yeah, if you remember this Beis HaMedrash, during off hours, you could ask to have the Beis HaMedrash for yourself, to learn and study and think privately Beis Bodidus. Ramchal is some very dedicated Talmidim. One that I mentioned before, the Graz doctor, Yecheskel Gordon, he was particularly curious. He really wondered, what does the Rebbe do? What's Moshe Chaim Luzzatto up to when he asks for privacy in the Beis HaMedrash? We don't know the stories that happened when there was no Talmud who stuck his nose in and peeked. The stories that we know are the stories that were recorded. So apparently, Rabbi Dr. Yecheskel Gordon hid himself somehow peeking through the window, hid himself in a closet, whatever it was. He somehow figures out that the Ramchal cleared the decks and had the Beis HaMedrash to himself. He was learning B'chavrusa with Eliyahu HaNavi. Hili Eliyahu. Yecheskel Gordon is incredibly taken by this. Sits on the information for a couple of months, and then decides to share it. But how does he share it? He writes a letter to the establishment communities in Germany, to Hamburg, Altoona, several others, telling them about their chabura and about their Rebbe, Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, who's such a young man, he isn't even married yet, hasn't even grown a beard yet, and he's learning and teaching Kabbalah, and he even has Gili Eliyahu. So historians are not sure to this very day what Yecheskel Gordon's objective was. Was this a fundraising letter? You got to wonder why a bunch of medical students need to fundraise for their shul and their Beis Medrash. Or was he just simply so proud of his chabur and his rabbi, he wanted everyone else to share in their pride? Whatever it was an incredible failure, and it boomeranged horribly. They get this letter, the established communities in Germany, they say, here's the next Shabtai Tzvi, the next proto-Sabbatean. It fit exactly exactly the profile they were worried about. Everyone knew that legitimate Lurianic Kabbalah, the Kabbalah of the Arizal, that he was so insistent that you fit a certain profile, a married Kabbalist who doesn't shave his beard whatsoever, and everything didn't fit. Here's this fellow teaching Kabbalah to a bunch of medical students. The whole thing. And he had all sorts of literary interests. Also, he was, I believe, at that point, already supporting himself, Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, as an optician. He was a lens grinder. And he was, in addition to the svarim that he had and would continue to author and publish, he was, as I mentioned before, a man who I'm not an expert in 18th century Italian playwriting would be the understatement of the century. But people who are entitled to opinion opine that the plays that he wrote, the plays that Moshe Chaim Luzzatto wrote, were of a very contemporary style. He was a poet of some note. What does a Rebbe give a Talmud as a gift when he graduates medical school? So if you're Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, you write him a souvenir poem. And we have some of those. Some of the Moshe Chaim Luzzatto's greatest Talmidim, many of whom ended up not practicing medicine because they became Kabbalists instead, of David Wally and I believe Rabbi Yecheskel Gordon. So we have the poems that the Ramchal gave them as a present upon their graduation from medical school. So he was sort of this very open, the whole thing didn't fit. And so they send the letters, started getting fired off from Germany to Venice, to the big establishment community. You got a problem, you got to stamp, you got to nip this in the bud. You get down to Padua and take care of business. And they begin to apply a lot of pressure. Moshe Chaim Luzzatto initially tries to convince them that he's legitimate, and he's real, he's authentic, and there's nothing to be worried about. And it got very, very tense. And they begin to impose limitations on the Ramchal's work and his writing and his teaching, and it's becoming very, very unpleasant. And ultimately, at one point, Rabbi Shai Bassan says to him, it's time to get married for a whole host of reasons, and you got to figure out how you're going to handle the pressure. After a couple of years, and we have this correspondence back and forth between Hamburg and Venice, between Venice and Padua, between Ramchal's Rebbe Yishayah Basan and him, and back and forth between Ramchal and the members of his Chabur, his Talmidim. And we have a letter in which he wrote to his Talmidim, probably delivered it orally as well, where he says, I'm going to leave. And they wanted him to stay, but he said, I'm going to do you a favor by leaving. You'll be able to learn in peace, you'll be able to grow in peace, and it's better for everyone if I just get out of town. And he leaves Padua for Amsterdam. Amsterdam was a far more tolerant community, and he was convinced that the Sephardic community in Amsterdam would welcome him with open arms, and he would be able to learn and teach unharried. The problem was that he left Padua in the fall. Now, 21st century, it's not a big deal. Leave Padua in the fall, and you get to Amsterdam. If you're flying or driving or taking the train, you know, a couple hours, maybe you take a scenic route, a couple of days. But this is the early 1700s. And he was going to take him, and he got caught. The snow began to fall halfway. So he gets stuck for the winter at the halfway point, which was Frankfurt, Germany, of all places. And it was a mixed bag. So on the one hand, he probably took some comfort in the fact that he got to spend the winter with a far more senior Talmud Chacham, who also had been suffered from being attacked by much smaller people and accused of being a crypto-Sabbatean. And that is none other than Rabbi Yonatan Eibeschitz, who was an elder Talmud Chacham living in Frankfurt, who had been attacked by Yaakov Emden and claimed the claims that he was a crypto-Sabbatean. So we imagine that Ramchal must have taken a lot of comfort from spending time commiserating Yonatan Eibeschitz. But he also had the misfortune of spending the winter with the people who had led the attack against him. Jacob Sasportis and several others, who were convinced that they were doing Melech HaShamayim in destroying the next Shabtai Tzvi. He is stuck, surrounded by snow for a couple of months. They seize, he had been traveling with a chest of what's estimated to be 100 to 150 manuscripts of Sfarim that he had not yet published, which were seized and confiscated by some members of the Jewish community of Frankfurt, and were apparently buried in a swamp outside of Frankfurt. There they lie decomposing to this very day. We can imagine the excitement. You know, we all often get excited about the changing seasons, but it's hard to imagine the degree of excitement that Moshe Chaim Luzzatto and his wife and children had when the snow melted and he was able to finally continue his journey northwest. He arrives in Amsterdam. And the Jewish community in Amsterdam, they were thrilled. They were honored that Ramchal, of all of Europe, he had chosen Amsterdam, and they were welcomed with open arms. And they arranged an enormous reception at Kabbalah's Panim, Chacham Baal'ir, Tzadik Baal'ir, and, you know, can imagine what it would look like. And then they, at near the end of the event, at the climax, they put up the guest of honor. They ask Moshe Chaim Luzzatto to address them. And they're expecting the Kabbalistic mystical sparks to fly. And nothing. He gives a nice shir, beautiful shir. But no spheres, no partsufim. And so for a very straightforward shir. And they're curious. But they figure, he's exhausted on a whole lot of levels. He's been traveling. He's been through the ringer. He needs a couple of weeks, a couple of months to recover. And then a while later, another Kabbalah spun him and another public event. And again, they put him up to speak. And again, he gives a beautiful, fascinating shiur, but none of the mystical depth and sparkle that they were expecting. And eventually they discover that when he was in Frankfurt, they had imposed a second set of limitations on him. They coerced him to swear that he would not teach Kabbalah, not in writing, not orally, in any which way. And we have the letters where he writes back to Italy that I was pushed around and I was coerced, I was manhandled, and it was terrible. That's their cheshbon with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But I gave my word. I'm going to keep my word. Even though I was mistreated horribly, I took an oath. I took a shvua. I'm going to respect that. And he writes to his Rebbe, Yishayah Basan, my own private learning will continue unabated. And he references the famous fable of the fox and the fish, or Rebbe Akiva tells the end of Maseches Brachos. but how a Jew without Torah is like a fish out of water. He says, I'm going to stay connected, but I gave my word I would not teach. I will not teach mysticism. And that's why when it came to Amsterdam, he was true to his word, and he gave beautiful shiurim, we imagine in Halach and in Tanakh and whatever else, but the Kabbalistic sparkle did not appear directly. And here we come back to where we began. So I told you before the sort of thing that may have, if you didn't go to MTA, may have brought back, you know, bad memories of stereotypical history classes, which were all, you know, names, dates, and figures. What could be less interesting? What could be more boring and more meaningless than the location and date of the first publication of a work? Who cares? Who cares that Maseilas Yesharim was first published in Amsterdam in 1740, in the Hebrew year 550, 500? Seems like an irrelevant detail. Until you have some context. And then you realize that Maseilas Yesharim, you sort of, perhaps some of us take for granted, a nice Musar Sefer. It was the first work published by the controversial clean-shaven Kabbalist, the Ramchal, after arriving in Amsterdam. The first major work, certainly. He publishes soon after his arrival in Amsterdam. Which means it's the first work published by this man of almost inestimable depth, such a multi-dimensional Talmud Chacham of the first water. It's the first sefer that he publishes after being muzzled, after being coerced to agree that he would no longer directly share any of the mystical sparkle. And so when you open Maseilas Yesharim, again, for the first time, after having met Moshe Chaim Lusato, you suddenly realize that maybe you notice that there are 26 prakim, the Gematria of Yudke Vavke. Maybe you notice that the Sefer is built around a ladder that's, as we'll read soon, Yaakov Avinu's dream of the Sula Mutzav Arza Veroshu Magia Shamaima, the ladder that's firmly rooted on the ground but reaches up to the skies, to the heavens, with 10 levels to the Sefer, which perhaps corresponds to the larger set of 10 spheros, 10 levels of our potential growth from step to step to step, progressively growing into human beings who are increasingly resonant with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with our feet planted on the ground, but our hearts and minds and souls growing closer and closer, step by step, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And you suddenly realize that you expect to find a sefer first published in Amsterdam, soon after Ramchal's arrival, that will be a sefer of incredible depth in very plain, simple language. And then you begin to appreciate that famous first paragraph and the introduction as a whole. We'll close a few minutes about the introduction, an appreciation and perhaps an invitation to open or reopen Maseilas Yesharim. The introduction, before he gets to his step-by-step manual for methodical, ambitious growth as a Jew towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the main assertion of the introduction is that Avodas Hashem is actually a field that requires serious intellectual rigor. There's a tremendous amount to study, a tremendous amount to think about, a tremendous amount to analyze if you want to do it right. The prelude to that is a very simple paragraph, the opening paragraph, the introduction, where he says, don't expect to find a lot of new ideas in my sefer. And he actually says very visually. He says, if you examine your brain, so before and after, you have a radiologist, at least one radiologist in the room, he says, if you were to scan your brain before and after reading my sefer, you'll find very few new ideas in your brain afterwards that weren't already there before. He says, don't expect to find new ideas. That's maybe the one line in Maseilas Yesharim. There are loads of new ideas. But he says, don't expect the main value of my sefer will not come from reading it once and, you know, coming across all these fantastic new insights. The value of my sefer, the impact of my sefer, will come from reviewing again and again, coming back to it, and I would add perhaps coming back to it again and again at different stages of life with different types of perspective. That's when you'll really begin to absorb my sefer. And perhaps part of what he's saying with that very simple-sounding introduction is that this is actually not a simple sefer at all. It'll read very simply, and it'll sound very nice. And the truth is, we would take issue with him and say there's an incredible amount of new ideas will come across, even in the first reading. An incredible amount of new perspectives you'll come across, even in the first reading. The way he organized the ideas, unbelievable. But the main value will come from returning to the sefer again and again over the course of a lifetime. You absorb, you begin to tap into what's going on beneath the surface, because most of this, the sefer is an iceberg, he's saying. Very simple presentation, but extraordinary depth. And he closes, and I'll close, well, he closes the introduction. And he says, by the end of the introduction, if I've convinced you of my primary assertion, that Avodas Hashem, that Yerushalayim and Midos and so forth are something that are not just a Musar Sefer, what depth could there be? But there's extraordinary depth and rigor that's called for in terms of really doing this right. He says, if we're going to do this in a rigorous fashion, so we have to begin by defining our terms. That would be the logical first place to start. So he says at the end of his introduction, well, what exactly is the scope of Avodas Hashem? What does Avodas Hashem consist of? What are its elements? And he says, I have no better primary source than the Chumash. One of the only direct questions asked in all, opposed to all of Chumash, outside of narrative, when the Torah is recording conversations, obviously there'll be, at times one person will ask another a question. But in the non-narrative portions of Chumash, this may be the only, if not one of the only, direct questions in Chumash. Parshas Ekev, Moshe Rabbeinu is speaking to the Jewish people. His final, all of Devarim is Moshe Rabbeinu's final sermon to Klal Yisrael. If you ever wonder, you're in visiting some other shul, and you visit some other shul, you think that they're speaking at great length. Just remember that Moshe Rabbeinu spoke for a month and a week. He started with Chodesh Shvat, and he ended Zayin Adar. Moshe Rabbeinu is a valedictory address to the Jewish people. And in the course of it, in Parshas Ekev, nothing's long after you think about that. In his valedictory address, he asked the Jewish people directly in Parshas Ekev, what does God want of you? Moshem Elkecha Shoelim Lach, a direct question. Ramcha says, that's exactly what I'm looking for. There you have it. What are the elements of Avodas Hashem? What are God's expectations of me? And he goes on to say, if you look, Moshe Rabbeinu gave a five-element answer. The last element is keeping the mitzvahs, which Ramchal explains in the manuscript version of Mesillas Yesharim even more directly. That refers to all the behavioral expectations which HaKadosh Baruch Hu has of us, the chovas ha'ivarim, the do's and don'ts of what we eat and what we say and how we do business. But four out of the five elements have to do with the inner life, the inner landscape of a Jew, the chovas ha'levavas, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's expectations of our minds and hearts. And he talks about fear of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Yiras Hashem, and following HaKadosh Baruch Hu's path, love of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and being wholehearted in the way we approach our Avodas Hashem. And I'll leave you with the following teaser. Those are terms that are familiar. And those are terms that, as observant Jews, we embrace. Yeah. Do you believe in Yiras Hashem? Sure. Do you believe in loving HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Well, absolutely. Do you have to love HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Is it obligatory? How do you know? When was the last time you mentioned Shema, right? You said it an hour ago, hour and a half ago. Avavta Hashem Elokecha. Rosh Chodesh. Avavta Hashem Elokecha. This is one of the most basic obligations of a Jew. Do you ever stop to ask yourself, when was the last time you did it, though? When was the last time you loved God? When was the last time I loved God? That's sort of a basic question. Like, if I believe that tzedakah is an obligation for a Jew, and I can look back at, you know, look, check the credit card statements, take a look at my checking statement, I can tell you the last time I fulfilled tzedakah, the last time I put some money in the pushka. I can talk about the last time I ate in a sukkah. I can talk about the last time I chose kosher food. Can you tell me the last time you loved God? And what did you do? What did that look like? That's a... And then you start to wonder, what exactly does it mean to love God? we mouth the words, of course we believe in them, we subscribe to it. What does it actually mean? What does it mean to fear God? Also, basic obligation. I don't see anyone shivering or shuddering. None of us seem theophobic. What does it mean to fear? HaKadosh Baruch Hu, supposed to be scared? Jews shouldn't be too calm. Jews should be walking around shuddering. Quakers. We should be quaking. Really? Is that normative Judaism? So the loving of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I leave you with that tease. You can take a look at the end of the Rabbi Chaya's introduction. You'll see what he says. But let's talk for a moment about that. We'll close that first element. The first of the five elements of Avodas Hashem is Yiras Hashem. And the Ramchal writes there elegantly in just a few spare lines of prose, built in large part probably on the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim, who is also quoted in the first page of Shulchan Aruch by the Rama, or Chaim Siman Aleph. And he points out that Yira has nothing to do, it would be incorrect to describe, to translate Yira as fear. Yira isn't fear. We're not obliged to be theophobic. Yira instead is a sense of presence. A great person walks into the room. If a great Talmud Chacham were to walk into the room right now, a Rosh Yeshiva whom we respect, so we would, we'd be a little, we act a little differently. We'd sit up a little differently. We would sort of catch ourselves. If we still have the gift of grandparents, or if we cast our minds back to when we had the gift of grandparents, a grandparent walks into the room, you act a little differently, you speak a little differently. Not because you're scared of what your grandparent's going to do to you, not because you're scared of what the great Talmud Chacham is going to do. Not scared, but there's a sense of presence. In the presence of particular people, different people, I act differently. It's a natural adaptation that we have. Yiras Hashem is a sense of the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's a God consciousness. If you ask me, do I believe in God? Yes. Do I believe that God created the world? Yes. Do I believe God continues to manage my life? Yes. Do I feel it in my gut? Maybe, maybe not. Do I act? Do I have this sense of the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu the way I would have a sense of the presence of another person if he or she walked in? That's the first major goal. The first target in a methodical, ambitious plan of growth in Avodas Hashem, the first of the five elements is developing that sense of the reality of the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in my life. That sort of God consciousness, everything else can flow from that. Once I have as I cultivate a sense of the realness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in my life, in my gut, not just in my brain, so then we can build upon that, crafting a character that's emulating the divine. Then we can build upon that in Avas Hashem, an emotional relationship with that God who is now a part of my life, and then everything else will flow from that. So I hope that this was a meaningful introduction. I said that when we opened to one of the most impactful Jews of the last 300 years, the controversial clean-shaven Kabbalist who continues to impact and inspire us to this very day. Once again, I want to thank Rabbi Zirkind and MTA for this opportunity to come with you and to join you on a Thanksgiving morning and to share words of Torah. I want to thank each and every one of you for coming out. Thank you so much. Thank you.
I'll send you